now on, all our lessons will be hybrid, live and Zoom. So anyone that's out of the country or can't come could join us tonight. Tonight, we're going to get to a very nitty-gritty of anti-Semitism. I call it the real, we call it the real Nicole. Why do they hate us? Why do they hate us? And what can we do to get this hatred on a less felt way? So why do they hate us? You could say that. And why, how do we get this hatred on a very low scale? So it's page, hold on a second. Page in the books, page. Yeah, page 48. Yeah, page 48. Okay, what we're going to do just for 3 minutes, even less, 2 minutes, I'm going to ask you if you could just read the two texts on page 48 and 49, just to yourself, just read to yourself. And tell me why they hate us, what claims do they make, and why the claims contradict each other. Now, one thing I just want to mention, I met a lot of people that say they hate Jews because they killed their Lord, you know, their God, you know, Jesus. So I once met one of them, I says, you know what, I'll make a deal. He said to me, we're good friends as personal friends, but I hate you because you killed my Lord. So I said to him, you know what, let's remain friends. And I give you permission, when you find my Lord, Mike, you could kill him also. So if I could kill your Lord, you could kill my Lord. Guess what, we remain friends for a long time. He never found the Lord. Because if there's a Lord that you could kill, that's not the Lord, that's Micah. You understand? So if you could just read text 1 and 2, it's basically before Christianity even started, they hated us. So the excuse that we killed the Christian Lord is just nonsense. If you remember, at least the first recorded anti-Semitism we ever have in the Torah was Haman. You know that he lived, let me see how many years ago, 2,580 years ago. Christianity is what, 2,000 years? A little less, a little more. And he already wanted to kill all of us. So the idea that we killed their Lord is not even true. That's not why you hate us. So text 1 and 2, this was written during the times of the Romans, a little before, and you could see why there was a plague that broke out. I'm just, while you read it, I'm just talking out loud about it. There was a plague that broke out in Egypt. What was the plague? Children were born disformed, you know, like, you know, whatever. So they couldn't figure out what's happening that children are born disformed. So they went to their idol to find out, and guess what happened? They blamed the Jews. What does the Jews got to do with your children born disformed? What does it got to do? Then they had this story with, I don't know if you remember, in the Dark Ages, they claimed the Jews poisoned all the water. I think over 800 million people died. So because the water was contaminated, so the Jews poisoned the water. Why would Jews poison the water? That's what it is. If you remember in the history, in I would say like close to 400 years ago, there were blood libels. You know what that is? They used to come out with these statements that Jews kill a Christian child and they use the blood of this child to mix with the matzah for Pesach. So when they bake matzah, they need to mix in it Christian blood. So the first time they came up with this nonsense story was in the year 1144. The government then didn't accept it. They were trying to make a whole trial, and they tried to prove that the Jews killed the Christian boy. The government said no, and then there was a big pogrom. 100 years later, in 1255, the Jews were accused, and in England, the King of England, Edward, number one, anyways, he expelled the Jews from England. And when? Almost like 400 years, Jews couldn't live in England. This was in the late 1200s, 400 years. Anyways, you read both texts, everyone read it? What do you find the common thread? Give me at least two things why they hate us.
I couldn't read it.
Okay, go ahead. Usually, I say always a good, nice Jewish mother can do 7 things at once. Answer the phone, cook, hold the child, clean the table, attend to the children, and they have everything at once. Like, they multitask. Okay, so I'll give 1 minute, read it quickly. Anyone have any? Just to tell me clear and short, what do you think? What's the reason they hate the Jews?
We don't accept JC.
No, this is before JC started. In year 2500. 500 BCE.
Didn't exist.
I know. No, anyone have? Yeah, what do you say? 2 things?
They both make false accusations without confirming them.
Okay, what other thing? Fear. Anything else? Anything else you find common? Okay. You want to say something, Robertson Beckles?
I don't like.
Custom? What kind of custom, for example? This is a text written 2,000 years ago, so it sounds a little strange. But... So, what kind of custom does he say or no in the text? Not really.
It seems to be general.
Just in general, different. They were different.
Different.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, so we'll go quickly. You can look at the PowerPoint if you want. Number one, I call it, they blame the Jews for different types of plagues. Now, I was surprised. I don't know if you read the media, COVID-19. You didn't have anyone that I knew of, right, blaming that it's a Jewish fault when COVID-19 broke out, right? But what's strange is that in the media, at least in part of the media, even though the Jews got the vaccine first in Israel, and they were like the first country to get everything. But there's a lot of media was saying that why is it that the Jewish country got the vaccine first? Why were they first? Why not everyone else? Why they chose it? oh, you know why? They must be in Kuwait, you know, like
cahoots.
And they try, because they brought the plague and they're trying to cover up bubble mice. Anyway, another interesting thing is they always blame Jews for living off the hard work of others. Like, we're the rich people. Everyone else is working hard. And we're like benefiting from their hard labor. You ever heard that claim? Like, we're always the boss of the company. You know, we own the business. Like, the world is working for us. That was a big claim they always had. And they always try to say, the Jew has to go take a hammer and a sledgehammer and go knock wood and go bang, you know, nails. Yeah, let them sweat for their. Another thing that you find a lot that they use many, many times is the Jews, they look down at the non-Jews. They call them goyim. You ever heard such an expression?
All the time.
They look at the Jews, these are goyim. They're nothing. Like, that's what they claim. So the question is, how do we deal with this? Now, if you go to text 3, on page 53, you have it? Can you read it? Any line? It's very. Let's read it loud for us.
Conspiracy theories are rarely logical. It is not surprising, then, that even as Al-Qaeda took credit for the September 11th attacks, the group did nothing to stop a rumor claiming that the Jews were really responsible. The rumor alleged that Israel, specifically Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, was behind the plot and had warned Jews not to go to work at the World Trade Center on the day of the attack. On September 18th, an editor for a website known as the Information Times posted a message claiming that the terrorist government of Israel cannot be ruled out as a suspect. The editor did not identify a motive or provide evidence in support of his allegation. In his words, he was simply raising a reasonable question. 5 days later, Al-Manar, a TV station based in Lebanon, stated that Mossad had indeed warned 4,000 Jews who worked at the World Trade Center to stay home on September 11th. Within days, that rumor appeared in newspapers and electronic mailing lists around the world. People continued to believe the lie despite the fact that about 18% of the known dead were identified in obituaries as Jews.
Now, I'll tell you the true story. What happened was that Tuesday of 9/11, if you remember, you remember that?
Yes.
It was the week before Rosh Hashanah. And what happened was that the week before Rosh Hashanah, Jews get up early in the morning and they say extra prayers, called slichos. So a lot of Jews that I know that live worked in the Trade Center, the only reason they didn't get it that morning, because they had another half hour of praying that they do the week before Rosh Hashanah. So by the time they got out of the train, the building was already, the first one at least, collapsed, so they knew they'd stay away. So a lot of people that usually get there didn't end up coming. But not because the Mossad warned them that there's an attack coming and please stay away. It's just the prayer took a half hour longer and that made all the difference. Some Jews got there and they didn't come back out. So to claim that the Jews were in charge of it, it's ludicrous, but people do. Now, I just want to end off before we get to the answer. I don't know if you remember this person. Do you remember this? This picture on the screen? You know who he was? Have you ever heard of the Warsaw Uprising? The Warsaw Ghetto? You familiar with it a little? You learned it in school? So this rabbi, he was called Rabbi Zemba, Menachem Zemba. And he was the rabbi of Poland, the chief rabbi. And he was at the Warsaw Ghetto. And he was there living with all the Jews. And he guided the Jews how to, you know, many halacha questions came up in the ghetto. And after 3 years, like when the ghetto was starting to be liquidated, the Nazis killed him in the, you know, they killed him in the ghetto and he is buried there. So he wrote a very interesting thing while he was in the ghetto. Why do they hate us? Like, why do they hate us? Why are the Nazis doing this to us? So look what he wrote, just a short text, text 4, and see the ludicrous of why they hate us. Go. Text 4.
There are those who seek to identify legitimate causes for the hatred of Jews. However, reality has shown that there is no legitimate reason. Anti-Semitism has no justifiable cause. The haters simply choose to hate God's people. This is demonstrated by the fact that Jews are hated for being capitalists and also for being socialists. They are hated because they are overly ambitious and sharp-minded, and also because they are indolent and parasitic. They are hated because they are too religious and conservative, and also because they advance progressive and secular ideas. The reasons for this hatred are consistently contradictory and have not an ounce of logic behind them.
Can you turn the page? We hear it really loud on the mic.
Okay, so what's the answer? Why do they hate us?
There's no reason.
Okay, I think what I want to do, if you give me permission, I want to get to the punchline. And because I'm so excited to share with you why they hate us, and you will be amazed. And it's funny, if you understand really why they hate us, you at least have the tools how to get them to hate us less and how to get them maybe not hate us at all. So I'm going to skip a few texts, the rest you can read to yourself. I'm going to go to text 8. Text 8 is on page 60. Okay. Read text 8 for us.
There has been an almost endless set of speculations about what the cause of anti-Semitism actually is. Some have seen it in psychological terms: displaced fear, externalization of inner conflict, projected guilt, the creation of a scapegoat. Others have given it a socio-political explanation. Jews were a group who could conveniently be blamed for economic resentments, social unrest, class conflict, or destabilizing change. Yet others view it through the prism of culture and identity. Jews were the stereotyped outsiders against whom a group could define itself. Yet others, noting the concentration of anti-Semitism among the very faiths, Christianity and Islam, that trace their descent to Abraham and Judaism, favor a Freudian explanation in terms of the myth of Oedipus. We seek to kill those who gave us birth. It would be strange indeed if so complex a phenomenon did not give rise to multiple explanations.
So I'm going to give you the answer. And it starts with a story. 2,500 years ago, there was the first anti-Semite. His name was Haman. But he wasn't really the first anti-Semite. 1,000 years before him, there was the first anti-Semite named Esau, which was the brother of Jacob. He hated his brother to the guts. He wanted to kill him. But here's an interesting story. Haman actually was the most powerful figure in the government besides the king. The king gave him the power to do anything. And the king in his times, 2,500 years ago, wasn't just the king of one country. It was the king of the entire world, 127 countries. So Haman was the second in power of the 127 countries. Haman comes one day and he says to the king, I want to get rid of a nation called Jews. And here is 10,000 silver coins. Right? So he goes to Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus. There's one crazy nation, he says. They act different, they're crazy people. They take every week, they take off one day, they don't work on Shabbos. Every few months is a holiday for a week. They just, every day they look for another excuse not to come to work. Guys, get rid of them. And here's 10,000 silver shekels. So Ahasuerus says, you know what? Keep the money. Keep the money. Here's my ring, you can get rid of it. So the Talmud says, what went on here? Here Haman brought 10,000 silver coins to pay and buy to kill the nation. Ahasuerus says, no, kill him for free. So Ahasuerus was also anti-Semitic. So what's the difference between Haman and Ahasuerus, the king? Haman says, I want to get rid of them. Ahasuerus says, no, do it for free. So the Talmud says, I'll tell you the difference, text 9. And this is the whole key. This text gives you the whole foundation of anti-Semitism.
We can use a parable to gain insight into the respective positions of Ahasuerus and Haman. They are similar to two individuals, one of whom has a tall mound in his field, whereas the other has a ditch in his field. The owner of the ditch mused to himself, I wish I could buy the tall mound to fill up my ditch. The owner of the mound said to himself, I wish I could purchase the right to dump my mound into his empty ditch.
Got it? Ahasuerus looks at the Jews, a pile, like a big pile of sand, a big pile in my field. It's just a blockage. I just want to get rid of it. Haman looks at the Jews that there's a big ditch in his field. So one sees anti-Semitism, these people, the Jews, are like a big pile of dirt, and they're just blocking me. I want to get rid of it. Haman, anti-Semitism is, the Jews are not just a big pile of dirt, but they make a big ditch in my field. They make a void. So Ahasuerus' hate to Jews was superficial. He just didn't like these dirty people, this despicable nation. It's a pile of dirt. They're just crazy people. Get rid of them, put them somewhere else. Haman was deeper. He says the Jews, you know why I hate the Jews? They make me feel like I have a ditch, that I have a void, that I'm missing something. So Ahasuerus looks at the Jews that they're extra. They're not needed. It's obscure. I don't need them. Let's take them. Haman feels that not only the Jews are extra, they make me feel that I am void, that I'm missing.
Inferior.
They make me feel like I'm nothing. Not only nothing, there's a ditch. There's like a hole in me. Could you imagine that? So Ahasuerus is looking at the Jew. Okay, you guys are extra. You're abstract, you know, you're meshuggah. Okay, let's get rid of you. Haman has a bigger problem. He feels that not only the Jews are extra, he feels the Jews are making him, Haman, feel that he's not only nothing, that he has a hole in him. There's a ditch. Why does Haman feel that? What made Haman feel that when he sees a Jew, it reminds him of what he's missing? You know, I could look at a person and say, you know what, I'm jealous of this person. Smarter than me. He's wealthier than me. She's the greatest scientist, whatever. Or I look at a person and they make me feel that I'm not only nothing, I'm garnished, you know, like I'm a piece of garbage. Who do you hate more? The one that makes you feel like you're a ditch, you're like a hole. You hate them even more. So Ahasuerus looked at us. Yeah, we're smarter, we're small. Okay, let's get rid of it. Haman, it was even worse because he felt that when he looked at a Jew, it made him feel that he has a hole in him. There's a void. So now there's two ways to respond. One, Haman, if he's smart enough, he says, okay, how do I fill my void? What am I missing? Why are they making me feel that I'm missing? That I have to fill my void? Or he gets rid of the Jew, so he doesn't have the guilty conscience of every time he sees a Jew, it reminds him of what he's missing. That's like, wow. There's a famous expression that, I mean, if you ever read, there was a book written. I don't know if it's a true book, but it's written. Someone claims he had a conversation with Hitler. Famous book. It's called, the title of the book is Hitler Speaks. I'm not saying you should read the book, I'm just telling you another thing. So they said, like, they were speaking to Hitler, what's wrong with the Jews? Like, what did he didn't like about the Jews? He says, the Jewish makes me feel like I'm a blemish. I'm a blemish, like there's a hole in. So now we have to figure out, what is it that they look at a Jew and they feel their void? Like, what do we do to them? What do we make them feel? So here's a very strange thing. We look at the story of the Purim. There was one more piece. Haman told his family, he had a party, I think he had like a few hundred people at his party, and he told them of all his wealth and all his greatness and how he's the second to the king and all his power. But this is what he said to his family. He says, the only thing I want you to know that even though I'm so powerful, but whenever I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the entrance, you know, when he walks in the street, it makes me feel worthless. So here's a strange thing. He's the second to the power in the world. He has the most wealth. Everything he has, hundreds of children. I mean, he has everything. But when he sees Mordechai, he not only, it looks like an extra pile of dirt, he feels like he's not worth it. What did Mordechai make him feel that he's not worth anything? So let's read text 10, one second, text 10. Haman
told them about his magnificent wealth and his many sons, and how the king had promoted him and advanced him above the other officials and royal courtiers. What is more, said Haman, Queen Esther personally prepared a feast, and besides the king, she did not invite anyone but me. And tomorrow, too, I am invited by her along with the king. But all this means nothing to me each time I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the palace gate.
Clear? So that means there's something in a Jew that when they see the Jew, makes them feel that they have a hole in them and they're nothing worth. What is it? What do they see in us that not only are they, you know, not special, but then like have a hole in them? What is it?
Yeah. I think that they feel that we're superior to them, you know, because we know about Hashem, we really know about Hashem, and we serve Hashem with all our heart, and that makes them feel like they're worth nothing. And also because, I mean, Haman himself, I mean, he hated Mordechai because Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. He wanted everybody to bow down to him, and Mordechai was the only one who wouldn't.
What? So I'll give you a few pieces here, and we'll put it together. The first thing that when a non-Jew sees a Jew, what reminds them is the purpose of why God created the world to begin with. I'll tell you why. What's that? Let me explain to you a very important thing. As a Jew, with getting the Torah, we realize that the world is not about us. It's not about me. It's not about my selfishness. It's about the purpose of the creation. What is Torah all about? What does Torah tell us? What does it say in the Ten Commandments and the 613 mitzvahs? All about what God wants for us to do in this world. So when a Jew, when you look at a Jew, what do you see? You see that the whole purpose of life is not about me enjoying life or me getting greater or bigger. It's about the purpose of why we were created to begin with, to serve God. And not only Jews, the whole world. But we bring that, and I'll give you an example. Jews are ready to give up their life for God. Imagine what that means. Why would you give up your life for God? If your whole attitude of life, it's all about my life and about me, and about me becoming a better person, and me being wealthier, stronger, or more intelligent, or a better job, whatever it is. So why would I give up my life for God? A Jew's whole way of thinking, no. I'm not living for me. I'm living with a purpose that God wants me to live for a certain amount of years, and a certain purpose, and I'm ready to give up my life. You know how many Jews give up their life for Judaism? Go through history. Many were killed and burned and martyred and who knows. Now, today in America, thank God, the last 100 years, we don't have that a test. But we do have challenges that many Jews gave up their personal, their personal dream of life, because they realized my main goal is to serve God and bring God to the world, not my life. So that's a very important thing that is distinguished by Jews, that the world sees it. And therefore, when Haman saw Mordechai, he couldn't handle it because it makes him feel that his whole life has no purpose. He's the wealthiest person. He's the most highest position, but without any purpose. It's all about himself. So whenever he looks at Mordechai, he realizes that's not what life is all about. So he feels a void. Who wants to feel a void? Another interesting thing is when a person lives a selfish life, what does he focus a whole day on?
Himself.
Or herself, whatever it is. So a whole day, it's all about me. I remember someone told me they went out on a date with a girl, and the boy was talking like for 3 hours. And the girl never had to sit and listen. She couldn't even look at her phone because she would get upset. And what was he talking about 3 hours to the girl? All about him. He has this great job. He's the smartest in the world. He was the smartest in his class. He's better than his teacher. Everything, all his strength. And the girl never has to listen to all his, how great he is. And after 3 hours, he says, you know, I'm so sorry I spoke so long about myself. I want to give you a chance to speak. Can you please tell me how you feel about me? So it's all... Even when you're speaking, it's all about him. So what kind of marriage is this? What kind of life is this? If your whole marriage is about yourself, the world is over. The same thing, this world, we are married to God. God married us. He took us out of Egypt. He gave us a Torah. He says, guys, we're making a deal. Let's get married. I'll give you health. I'll give you wealth. I'll give you children. I'll give you everything. Just do one thing. Bring my name known to this world. Bring me out. Show me who I am. So a Jew in the mind and in the Torah, what's ingrained in our mind? That our whole life is not about me. It's about the purpose of God. When they look at us, they start to remind themselves, hey, so why am I here? Is it about me? It's about a purpose. So you have two choices. Haman was a little foolish. You have two choices. Either as a Gentile, you say, okay, so Jew, could you tell me what my purpose is? God created 7 billion Gentiles. It wasn't a mistake. So Haman could have said to Mordechai, could you teach me why I'm here? And Mordechai said, no problem. There's 7 Noah laws, and I'll help you be a good Gentile. And he wouldn't have that void in him. Instead, he says to Achashverosh, I can't stand these people that make me feel void. Let's get rid of them. So that's a very important thing. Another interesting thing is what happens with Jews. How many Jews in the world are there? Let's say 16 million, 18 million. Let's say, how many of the 18 million Jews do you feel really are fulfilling their purpose of life, of what God created them from the 18 million? I'm asking you, what do you say? From 18 million, how many?
5 million.
What do you say from the 18 million that they, you feel that they're conscious all about what they're here for?
Yeah.
Maybe. 5 million? What do you say? 18 million. Wow. He's the most optimistic.
Like I said, he's married.
Yeah. So I'll tell you.
They do it.
No, I'll tell you why I'm saying
they're born like this. That's it.
In Germany, there was a statement that was written by a Jewish philosopher, but he was Maskil. He was an enlightened. He wrote a statement that Jews lived in Germany. It says, Yehudi beveisecha, Adam beveisecha, and Yehudi beveisecha, which is when you go outside your house, be a regular human being. But when you're in your house, you're Jewish. You understand what I'm saying? Many Jews in Germany, when they went outside the house, they tried to be like all the other. They tried to look like everyone else. And in Germany, the Holocaust started. So the answer to anti-Semitism is not saying to them, let's be like you and be a void. Just the opposite. Let me show you how to fulfill your purpose. But there's many Jews that don't. Now, anti-Semitism is not only caused by religious Jews. Any Jew they see, they hate. It's not, even if you're a Jew that doesn't do anything Jewish, they still hate you, and maybe even more. And the answer is that even a Jew that doesn't fulfill their purpose, and they're not doing what, so to say, their purpose was, they are still have a godly soul, and subconsciously, they are connected to God, and subconsciously they do good things and they do great things. So Haman, whenever he saw any Jew, observant, non-observant, yes, observant, didn't make a difference, it reminded him his void. Because even a non-observant Jew is still connected. Like the Jew that comes in Kippur, right? I told you the story with the Jew. It was like 3 years ago. I said to him, you know, why don't I see you a whole year? Let me see him, Kippur. He says he's from the Secret Service. So he's like hidden, you don't see him. So I said, what's with Yom Kippur? So at first he says, I'm an atheist and I'm a chayes antagonist, whatever, all the things he could say. So I said, so if you're an atheist, why are you in shul? I mean, he says, where else would a Jew be on Yom Kippur? Where else would? The point here is that Haman's feeling towards Jew had, even if a Jew doesn't fulfill their purpose, they're really still fulfilling their purpose subconsciously, so he still had to hate them anyway. That's what I'm trying to figure out. The other thing is, which is very important. There's many Gentiles that are religious, like Christians that are very religious Christians. They follow whatever part of the Ten Commandments. You know, there are Muslims. Muslims officially have like a, they believe in God. They believe in Allah. They have rules, you know. So when they look at a Jew, do they feel void? Or they're fulfilled because they do what their religion tells them? That's what I'm asking you. Because we're saying that the reason Haman hated us, because he felt that he's void, that he's not doing his purpose. But there are many Gentiles that are religious and do their purpose, and still they hate us, you know, through history. So how could that be? And the answer is a very interesting answer. That there's two ways to be religious. You ready for this one? You know, when someone gives you, let's say, $100 million, that's a charity, it's a tzedakah. There's two attitudes. One is, I'm giving the $100 million, you know why? Because I want to feel good about myself. I want to feel accomplished. I want to feel that I achieved something. You know, it's all about me accomplishing a goal. In Judaism, the reason you give the $100 million is not because you're trying to accomplish a goal. You're giving the $100 million because that's the right thing to do. That's what God wants. It's not about me accomplishing something. So in a lot of religions, the whole religion is how you're feeling. I'm feeling good. I feel this. It's in my heart. It's about how I feel, how I'm good, and how good I am. This. In Judaism, it's not about your feelings or not. You got to do this, whether you feel good or not. This is the right thing to do. In Judaism, there's less emphasis on how you feel and more emphasis on action. Do the right thing to do, even if you don't feel good about it. Even if you don't feel you want to do it, it doesn't make a difference. The thing is done. In other religions, it's all how you're feeling about it. I feel loved. I feel loved. You should feel. In Judaism, it's all action, action, action. Why? Because it's not about you. It's about the purpose. So in Haman, even if he was religious, his religious was about himself. It was about him fulfilling his ultimate achievement. When he looks at a Jew, he sees something totally opposite. It's not about how they feel. It's about the purpose of the goal of life of God. And that gives him the void. So now the question is, okay, we know already about that they hate us. So the question is, so what should we do to get the anti-Semites not to be anti-Semites? Now we know the reason. Either because we're a pile of dirt, like Ahasuerus, or because we make them feel void, like Haman. So we know the reason. Well, what should we do to get rid of that reason? How do we diminish that? Low profile. Do you agree with that? We should be low profile?
No, the opposite.
You say the opposite. What do you say?
I believe that training and teaching is the answer.
Damn.
Given the opportunity, if they will listen, you teach them. Because many Goyim do learn that they are supposed to treat the Jews properly because we are God's chosen.
Do you really feel?
Example, yeah, you take this Reverend Abe down in Texas, I think. He raises more money for Israel. Look at the group that sends Jews to Israel.
Nefesh B'Nefesh.
What is it?
Nefesh B'Nefesh.
Right. That's primarily funded by Goyim to send Jews to Israel. Not for the purpose of conversion, but if we fulfill our goal of getting all the Jews to Israel, their observance will allow them to be sustained.
So let me just say, we'll read text 11, something very important. Have you, anyone ever experienced bullying in a classroom?
Yes.
Being bullied?
Yes.
Were you ever bullied? You ever bullied?
Thank God.
Thank God. I could be, I was, but that's the outcome.
Didn't last long.
But I'm a product of being bullied. But anyway, the point I'm bringing out is, whose fault is the bully? Is it the one that's being bullied or the one that's bullying?
The bully.
If you ask the bullier, the one that's bullying, he says, well, you know, I'm bullying him. He's, you know, they give all these reasons. He's fat, he's overweight, he brings toys every day.
He's Jewish.
There's nothing, the one that's being bullied, there's nothing he has to change it. Because it's not going to make a difference. Same thing when someone hates you and he says 100 reasons why he hates you, that's not going to change. If you change all the things he tells you, nothing's going to change. He's still going to hate you. He'll find something else. That's why he said, look at text 11. Say.
Jews must fight anti-Semitism, but never internalize it. That is easier said than done. If you are hated, it is natural to believe you are hateful, that the defect lies in you. It rarely does. Hate exists in the mind of the hater, not in the person of the hated. Jews have faults, and Judaism is a religion of self-criticism and repentance. But those faults have nothing to do with those of which they are accused by their enemies. Anti-Semitism tells us about anti-Semites, not Jews. One of the mistakes made by good, honorable, and reflective Jews was to believe that since Jews were hated, because they were different, they should try as far as possible not to be different. So some converted, others assimilated, yet others reformulated Judaism to eliminate as far as possible all that made Jews and Judaism distinctive. When these things failed, as they did, not only in 19th century Germany and Austria, but also in 15th century Spain, some internalized this failure. Thus was born the tortured psychology known as Jewish self-hatred.
So what is Jonathan Sacks saying? That by us trying to deal with anti-Semitism, either by changing us, whether it's changing our ways, trying to adopt to them, there were many people say we should have intermarriage, so they feel like the one family, be like them, that's not gonna change.
I have a question. It's like now we've assimilated a lot of people. I feel like I've assimilated. There's no difference between me and people who are non-Jewish, like the way that we live our lives, basically. And so they still hate us, but why do they feel less seeing us? Like, your explanation didn't really answer that for me. Why would they feel less looking at me? I look just and act basically just like them.
Oh, you want to know why they still hate you?
Yes.
Even though you're assimilated.
Right.
Because since you have a godly soul, subconscious, and your godly soul is there anyway. So even though you're behaving assimilated like them, you didn't really change. You're still that Jew that is connected to God anyway. So maybe exterior and to the face, you look and act like them, but the true you is totally different. So for example, I gave an example with charity, but there's many examples that, you know, there is something that the Jew has that is connected to selflessness, all about the purpose of why we're here rather than about ourselves. So like you'd be ready to do things even though you don't act everything in life as the Jews acting officially, but there is in every Jew that innate core that will never disconnect of being a Jew and always be ready to give the life just to be a Jew. So if someone comes over to you right now and says, you know what, you don't act Jewish, you don't dress Jewish, you don't talk Jewish, you don't know Yiddish, you don't even know what Meshuggah means, except me and you know. Are you ready to give up your Jewish identity and just change? You're no more Jewish. Are you ready? I'll give you $1 million. I'll give you 100. Never. Why? You no matter what, you still are 100% connected to that selfless core of you and God. So yes, it's not always visible, but subconsciously it's always there. And it comes out in different ways, and they sense it. They sense it. You know, they feel it. So let's say in Germany, which was the best example, in Germany, the Jews didn't act Jewish. They acted like this rest. And the Nazis killed all of them. Why? They still knew that the true core of that Jew, that on the outside is acting, is really the essence of them and the true souls connected to God, and they'll never give up who they are.
We got the blessing.
Yeah. You understand a little what I'm saying? You could see it many times, and I see it a lot. Like when I meet people that they have nothing to do with Judaism, but there are certain core things that they just, they'll fight till the end because they're Jewish. You understand what I'm trying? But they'll just, no matter what, I don't give this up. Maybe I don't do anything, but this I'm sticking with. To the point that they're ready to even give up everything else, not to give up that.
Like Yom Kippur.
Give as an example, but you're never going to give up that you're Jewish. You see, in other religions, what makes them, let's take Christians or Catholics or Muslims, what makes them a Muslim and a Catholic or a Christian is the religion. So if you follow this religion, you're Muslim. If you follow this religion, you're Christian. What happens if a Christian wants to change? They want to become Muslim. So that means they accept a different way of living, right? They accept a different life. In Judaism, it's not like that. In Judaism, you can never be not Jewish. You can't say one day, okay, I'm converting to Islam. You could say it, but you're still Jewish. Why? Because what makes you Jewish is not your religion. What makes you Jewish is that you're Jewish. As I always give an example, people don't like the example, but I give an example of a monkey came over to me once. Says, I want to, it was a nice monkey, by the way. He had 10 fingers like a man, 10 toes. Exactly, he looked like a human in a way. Sometimes behaved better than humans. And they asked him, he wants to change. Instead of a monkey, he wants to be a cat. He likes a cat. Why? I don't know, he wants to be a cat. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do anything to change you from a monkey to a cat. Your essence is a monkey. You maybe could act like a cat. You can maybe eat mice like a cat. I don't know, but you are gonna always be a monkey. A Jew, their being, it's not a religion. Jew, just the fact that this is your being, this is your gene, this is your essence. You are a Jew. So even a Jew that acts like a monkey, so to say, or acts like a cat, or acts like a tiger, or acts like an elephant, what is their core? Is they're Jewish. So the Jew hater knows that and senses that, which comes out in different ways that the Jew doesn't even realize. And that core connection is, this is your self-sacrifice, your selflessness. Like you said, Yom Kippur, but there's many other examples. Like you'll never give up your Judaism, no matter what. So how do we deal with it? So I'll tell you, look at a story of text 12. You know the story? With Rabbi Avraham Twersky. You know the story or not?
I just read it today. It was so cool.
It's a nice story. It's a true story, by the way. I heard it from him. Text 12.
I was once traveling on a bus, dressed in my customary garb, wearing a broad black hat and a black frock coat. A man approached me and said, I think it's shameful that your appearance is so different. There is no need for Jews in America to be so conspicuous with long beards and black hats. I'm sorry, mister, I said to the man. I'm not Jewish. I'm Amish, and this is how we dress. The man became apologetic. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, sir, he said. I did not mean to offend you. I think you should be proud of preserving your tradition.
double standard.
What happened? By the way, the one that asked the question was Jewish.
Mm-hmm. That happens a lot, right?
That's always happened. So what happened? Why the Amish could and a Jew can't? Now here I want to take it one step further. If we will be different, you know, let's say we dress different, we eat different, we believe different, it's not only for us a benefit, it's a benefit for the whole world. You know why? Because in the world, there's many different types of people. Dress differently, eat differently, think differently, believe differently. So us being different is not only going to squash anti-Semitism, as we'll soon see, but it'll help that the rest of the world will respect people that are also different. You think we're the only different? The Amish are also different. But the Amish you have to respect. It's the Amish. And what's with the Jew? We have to be the difference. We have to do it proudly. Now, there was once in the Soviet Union, there was a Soviet official that spoke to Refusnik. You know what a Refusnik is? Refusnik is a Jew that wants to leave Russia and leave go the Soviet and communist belief. You know, they want to move to either America or Israel. So there was a Jew that wanted to move to America. So the Soviet official says to him, I want to ask you a question. Why do you want to move to America? Because you have freedom of speech. In Soviet Union, you could also have freedom of speech. Like, what are you going to gain by moving to America? Here we have freedom of speech in Soviet Union. And in America, you have freedom of speech. Why have to run? So the Jew says, you're right. You're right. But in America, he says, I'm also guaranteed freedom after the speech. So between, I have freedom of speech, but after that, I don't have any freedom. You understand the point? The point here is that to fight anti-Semitism is by assimilating. And that is not going to do anything. It's like the bully telling the one that's being bullied, change. It's not gonna do anything. So what do we have to do? So let's go to text 13.
In the first three decades of my life, I never wore a Magen David necklace. It always seemed redundant to me. But since the Pittsburgh attack, I have worn a Jewish star pendant regularly, especially in public venues and in situations where I am conscious of being one of the only Jews in the room. The show of pride has become important to me. I want people to know that I am unafraid. This is the example set by Mitchell Leichner during his middle school graduation this spring in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Leichner doesn't usually wear a kippah, but the Poway shooting changed things for the 14-year-old. It was important to make a statement that we're still here and that no matter what happens, we'll still be here, he said.
Is that clear? I saw this 2 nights ago at the Shulchan convention, the conference. There was a shliach that was sent to Siberia. Siberia is a part of Russia that in the winter, the temperature is usually 40 below. Fahrenheit, 40 below zero. So many years ago, before he moved to Siberia, before he got married, he said to his wife, listen, my dear wife, I just wanted to know when we get married, I want to move out and open a Chabad center somewhere. So his wife said, only on one condition. I'll let you open a Chabad center anywhere, but not in Russia. That's the only place I don't want to go. He said, okay. So they got married, and after a year, he was looking. So the head rabbi of Russia said to him, you know, I have a whole continent in Russia called Siberia. This is a big place, Siberia. It's not a little, and you ever look at the map how big Siberia is? It's like, it's almost like the size of Canada, right? So I need to go there for a few weeks and see how it works out. So he went for a few weeks and there was one shul there in Siberia that still there for 100 years, you know, broken down, you know, nothing. So it was like a Purim time or before Purim, he made like a little event, invited some Jews, you know. And it was very nice. And he was going to go back to Israel and say, it's not for me, you know. Anyways, 2 days before he went back to Israel, he came to the shul and he saw there was a pogrom. They took everything in the shul and they turned everything upside down. They broke all the lights and all the chairs and all the windows. The Torahs were on the floor. The mezuzah was on the... I mean, it was like, you know, like you read from this ancient history. This is what, 25 years ago, 20 years ago. So he didn't know what to do. He was like, wait, this is like Nazis here, you know? So he called the head rabbi of Russia, Rabbi Lazar, in the middle of the night. He says, what do I do? He says, you know what we got to do? He says, we change our policy. We used to think that when they do programs or anti-Semitism to us, we should be quiet. No. Let's call all the newspapers in Siberia, all the newspapers in Russia. Let's have a news conference, and let's make this known to everyone. Let's spread the word. So the next day, they have a news conference, all the news come, and they ask the rabbi what happened, and he says the whole story, and they show pictures. So they ask him this question. They ask him, are you the rabbi of Siberia? Are you the one? Are you the... And he didn't know what to answer because he officially is going back to Israel with the intent of not coming back. But they put him on like a spot. If he says no, then they're going to say, so what are you complaining about? He says, yes, I'm the rabbi. Okay. Then the Israeli newspapers called, and then the government, he called the government official. He made a big noise. Anyways, and all the papers riled. You heard what happened in Siberia. They made a pogrom, and this is the rabbi Chabad. Goes back to Israel, and all his friends are hugging him. He says, wow, you went through a pogrom. You spoke so well. And so then he tells, after a few weeks, he tells his wife, Reverend, I want to tell you something. All the news and everyone knows we're the rabbi of Siberia except us. So let's already tell everyone. Anyways, make the long story short, he now in Siberia, in that place, huge school, shul, mikveh. I mean, the place is like, you look at it, you don't believe it exists, you know? On the contrary, putting up a menorah on 9W, in Englewood Cliffs, putting up a menorah every town is not only not going to bring anti-Semitism, it's going to show that differences is good. We're all there. Let's take text 14.
In this fact, perhaps, lay the greatest service of the medieval Jew to mankind. It was a period when authority was triumphant in the intellectual sphere. When thought was circumscribed even more than practice, when uniformity had established itself, not as an accident, but as a principle throughout European life. Had the state of affairs continued unchallenged, progress, scientific as well as philosophical, would have been impossible. The mere fact that the Jew existed and that he preserved the habit of independent thought helped to save the world from this menace. It was impossible even for the least original mind to fail to realize that in the Jewish quarter there existed a class as intelligent, at least as other men were, who yet did not believe as other men, who possessed literature and beliefs and practices which were not like those of the rest of the world, and who refused to pay even lip service to the prevailing ideas. This very fact saved the world from accepting uniformity finally as a natural thing. It stimulated students and thinkers to realize the existence of other spheres to conquer, over and above those which were delineated from the pulpit. And if from time to time, Europe shook off its lethargy and began to re-examine for itself the wells of human thought, the propinquity of the Jew was in part responsible.
Now, I just want to say one thing, and we'll conclude with the last two texts. When Esther came to her husband Achashverosh and told her that who she was, that she's Jewish, and Haman wants to kill the Jewish people, he, the king, never knew that his wife was Jewish. They didn't know for many years. Then, when he said Jewish, so what did he say? What did the king say? He said, I don't understand. When Haman came to me, he made it sound that these Jewish people are like crazy people, like not normal, no kindness. So he says, Esther, you're Jewish. From all the girls in the 127 countries, who did I pick to marry? You. I didn't know you were Jewish. But why did I pick you? I saw you're a kind person. You're a giving person. You're just a person that represents the kindness of the world. You represent the truth of the world. You represent the epitome of happiness, of purpose, of life. And I just wanted you. And you're Jewish? That's what Jews are? So how could you get rid of these people? So she didn't, what did she say? She just said to Achashverosh one thing. You know who I am? I'm the Jewish people that Haman just, and that's who he wants to get rid of. So Achashverosh said, what are you talking about? I can't believe it. You're Jewish? Haman made me think that Jews are like a piece of, like a ditch or garbage. So he says just the opposite. If a person wants to get rid of a Jew, means who's the problem? Not the Jew. The person is the problem. So we have to get rid of the Haman. It's like when the Nazis got up, right? For them, the Jew is the problem. No, the Nazi is the problem. So just like in bullying, you know, the bullier doesn't have to, the one that's being bullied doesn't change. On the opposite, the Jew has to be proud of who they are. Because the people that hate you has nothing to do because you're different, just the opposite. You be a good person and the way you should be. And they are going to have two things, going to make a choice. Either they're going to say, you know what, let's fill our void and let's do what God wants us to do as Gentiles. And that's what we should teach them. Rather than get rid of us, let me help you be your potential so you won't feel the void. I'll show you how every Gentile of the 7 billion Gentiles has a purpose of why God created them. And each one is unique and each one has a mission that God wants them in this world so they won't feel a void. You understand what I'm saying? So that's basically a text, which text was that? Text 14. So we're not going to read it, but we're going to go to text 16. Page, huh? Oh, 15. Text, go to text 16, page 72. This was a well-known Palestinian that for many years, he, you know, is the greatest anti-Semite. And then everything changed. What happened? Look in text 16.
I started going with my father to Hadassah in Karim Hospital for his chemotherapy. And to my shock, I started to observe that the doctors and the nurses treated him as a patient. The doctors were very friendly, and the nurses were also. He would bring them fruit, flowers, and chocolate. And I noticed in the hospital that Palestinians are also receiving treatment. That actually awakened me to a great extent to the humanity in the other. And it also awakened my humanity. This was the starting point.
And he became the biggest, he was the first one that took a group of Palestinians to Auschwitz to see what the Jews went through. He, this great anti-Semite, changed. And he was fired from the Palestinian party because how could you, he did a crime. He took his people to Auschwitz, which they claim it never happened. So how did he change? Not because the guy took off the mezuzah of the door, not because the guy took off his yarmulke. He saw how the Jews were good people. And he said, let me be a good person. Instead of being like Haman and get rid of the bully, let me be good and fill my void so I won't feel the emptiness. That's what we need to do today. And it's interesting, there's going to be a time, which is already happening now, that the Torah tells us that they won't hate us anymore. Where does it say that in the Torah? In text 17? And you see it happening. We don't have anti-Semites like we used to have, right?
No, we do.
No, we don't. I went through 6 billion of them. There's only 1 billion that may be on. But 6 billion on them. Okay, let's read text 17. The last text.
The wolf will dwell with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the young goat. These words are a metaphor and a parable. The interpretation of the prophecy is that the Jews will dwell at peace together with the wicked Gentiles who, like a wolf and leopard, has sought to devour them.
There's a famous prophecy from Isaiah that when the Mashiach will come, the wolf will live with the lamb. Or the lion, what is it? The lion with the goat, yeah. So in the simple translation of the words means that the animals, let's say the lion will be able to live with the sheep, and the wolf will live with the, they're not going to eat each other up. But the Rambam says, Maimonides says, that this is also a metaphor for the nations. The Jews is like a lamb. And the nations around us is like the animals, all the lions, and there'll be a time when we're going to live together peacefully. Why? Not because we're going to change, but we're going to help them fill the void that they feel when they see us, because we're going to help them fulfill their mission, because they're created by God. They also created in the image of God. So we're going to help them fill their mission. And when they fulfill their mission, they're going to say, I don't feel empty. Haman thought, let me get rid of the Jew because he makes me feel nothing. But if I can help you, I'll just end off with a little story so we finish it. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe in the late 1700s, 1798, he was in prison and for 53 days, and the Tsar of Russia came to visit him in prison because they told him he's a holy man. And in this prison usually was criminals. And this Rebbe was a holy man, so he wanted to visit him. But he got dressed up as a simple person. So when he comes to the cell where the Rebbe was sitting, the Rebbe stands up. And he says, why are you standing? He says, you're the king. You have to stand up, respect. He says, you ever saw me? He says, no. He says, how do you know I'm the king? He says, because every person has an angel that walks with them. You have your angel. A king has two angels. And I saw two angels walking in with him. So the king says, okay, let me ask you a question. He says, I learned the Bible, the Torah. And it says that when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, right? They were in the garden. God told them, don't eat from this tree, from everything else you could eat. And then what happened? They ate from the tree. So then they were hiding, and then God comes and says to Adam, the first word he says to him is Ayeka. What does Ayeka mean? Where are you? There you go. Where are you? And Adam says, well, I ate from the tree and I was hiding. So the king, the Tsar, the Russian Tsar, says to the Rebbe, God doesn't know where Adam is. Like, why would God, if we believe that God knows everything, he doesn't know where Adam is? Like, what kind of question? So he first gave him the answer that Rashi gives. He just wanted to start a conversation. It's like, hello, how you doing? Good morning. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, of course God knows where he is. It's just God wanted to start a conversation. So he says, Adam, where are you? Oh, I'm hiding. So the Tzar says, Rebbe, give me a better answer. I need something more. What's the answer?
He didn't ask where he is. He asked him where he is so that Adam can think about himself, what he's doing.
So instead of very good, he must have gone to Chabad school or something. So he said, so God said, so he answered this, the Rebbe answered the Tzar, God didn't ask Adam where you are, like where, no, where are you? Meaning, I know where you are, but where are you? Do you know where you are? Meaning, what are you doing here this world? I gave you just one mitzvah. Which mitzvah? Don't eat from the tree. Just one mitzvah. Jews have 630, but Adam only had one mitzvah. And you messed up. So where are you now? What is your whole life all about? You messed up your whole mission. So it's not where you are, but where are you? Where are you all? And that's the question that God asks every human being every day. I'm giving you another day today. But one question I ask you, where are you? Not where you are, where are you? I'm giving you another day for what reason? To have another slice of pizza? Or to go to kfir and have a sandwich? I mean, kfir is a good place to have a
sandwich. Yeah, it's kosher.
Yeah, that's not the point. So in other words, every morning when we wake up, every human being has to ask themselves one question, where am I? What am I here for? What's my purpose of life? Why is God giving me another day? Every human being. You know what I'm saying? It's not unique. So if we could get the whole world to ask that question, there won't be any anti-Semitism. Guaranteed. Because anti-Semitism is only because you feel, you when you look at a Jew, you feel you're empty. You feel like a ditch, like Haman. But if I can make you feel good, and fill your void, you're not going to hate me anymore. You don't have to get rid of me. Anyways, I'm finished for today. And I hope by next week we won't have any anti-Semitism. Is that a good blessing?
Amen.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Sorry that it went so long. But we have to cover this important thing. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Have a great night.